Hello, and welcome to Australia Day on RN. I'm Joe Gelonesi. Jonathan Green returns with Sunday Extra next Sunday morning from 7. This morning, we're bringing you the Australia Day Address, delivered by the 2013 Australian of the Year, Ita Buttrose, recorded at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music a few days ago. And later this hour, a wonderful feature about our unofficial national anthem, Waltzing Matilda, and the controversies over its origins. Ita Buttrose, the first woman to edit a major metropolitan newspaper in Australia, has some forthright views on our national priorities. Fighting ageism, freedom, researching dementia, increasing the number of women in senior roles, and how we treat the most vulnerable members of our society. Much to engage with in this wide-ranging talk. Here's Ita Buttrose.
I'm honoured to have been asked to deliver this Australia Day Address. Of all the events I've had the privilege to be part of as Australian of the Year, this occasion is easily the most daunting because I am reflecting on an extraordinary year, one to which I want to do justice and one that I shall never forget as long as I live. It's not easy to adequately capture the myriad impressions and thoughts that have filled my life in the last 12 months, and then to be here with you this evening to talk about our great country and the challenges and opportunities we face. As a journalist, I like what we call a good story. So let me start with people and their stories. It is to the many Australians who have shared their stories with me during 2013 that I would most like to give my thanks and tell them how much I have appreciated their openness and courage in sharing what often have been harrowing experiences. Without wanting in any way to romanticise the struggle that many Australians face, it's the spirit they display in tackling their everyday lives that will be an enduring memory for me. Hope is probably the best catch-all word I can use to sum up the essence of what I've heard through 2013. It's hope that gives us the resilience and drive to achieve the better life we want for ourselves and those we love. If we don't have hope, it's that much harder, I would suggest impossible, to shape a vision and then find the motivation to strive for it. So nurturing hope and keeping it alive in Australia is vital if we want a society of healthy, well-balanced individuals. A healthy human spirit never gives up. And I think that is how we Australians like to see ourselves. The Australian spirit is also about lending a hand, helping those who need it the most, and ensuring that we all get a fair go. I sometimes think we underestimate these particular strengths of ours and our resilience and our drive. Our national self-image is so linked to being laid back that we often fail to make the most of our amazing can-do attitude, something I believe is innate within the majority of us. Think of all the people we've seen recently on TV who've lost their homes in the bushfires that have ravaged so many of our states. Some say they will rebuild. Others say they will live on the land in a caravan or a tent until they have the money to get going again. And not surprisingly, several say they will move elsewhere to put down their roots. But from my experience, few, even those still reeling from what has occurred and in some cases coping with post-traumatic stress disorder, doubt that ultimately they will overcome the disaster that hit them. It is these qualities that we possess which gives me the confidence to believe that in time, all Australians will adopt more positive attitudes to ageing, be more inclusive of people with dementia and disabilities, and adopt social policies that ensures our country targets the precious resources we have to those who most need them. I don't think we reflect enough on Australia's history, on the very foundations on which our country is built. We find the time to celebrate nation building through our military exploits, younger generations learning about the past through Gallipoli and the Western Front, all of which is a good thing. But let's not forget or whitewash the frontier wars with Australia's first people in the process. and daily wall-to-wall sports commentaries on all our media outlets guarantee that our past and present sporting achievements will never be forgotten. But in my view, we don't reflect on and celebrate enough our development as a society and on the great social policies of which we should be so proud. In his thought-provoking book, Dreaming Too Loud, Geoffrey Robertson suggests that we have become captive of our own stereotypes at sport, both within our own psyche and the image we project to people overseas, and therefore that they hold of us. He writes, "We never seem to boast about how we pioneered universal suffrage and votes for women and maternity allowance, how we invented the secret ballot and the basic wage, how our miners at Broken Hill achieved the 35-hour week for workers in dangerous jobs 50 years before that idea caught on overseas. These are some of the things that surely should contribute to our self-image. Our history portrays us as a nation committed to giving its people a fair go, but in that peculiar Australian way of ours, this is countered by the realistic appreciation that life is not fair. We all know that we live in a time of economic difficulty. And with this comes the risk of people becoming inward focused and less conscious of their obligations to others. We need to keep reminding ourselves that social reform and economic responsibility can go hand in hand. It's not a matter of either or. I warm to the thought that in the past, in the 1890s and the first part of the last century, and again in post-World War II, in those years, Australia was able to achieve nation building with social reform, and we did it in a distinctly pragmatic way. As Manning Clark frequently observes in his short history of Australia, Australians have been reformist rather than radical in achieving economic and social change. In recent times, both sides of government have said that a government will be tested by how it treats its most vulnerable citizens, and I couldn't agree more. But I worry that our preoccupation with balanced budgets will lead to the chipping away of the things that protect the most vulnerable in our community and could create the risk of us turning our backs on what are very necessary, difficult and complex social reforms. As one of the wealthiest nations in the world, this would be unforgivable. We often do forget just what a lucky country we are. A report from Credit Suisse, released last October, identified Australia per capita as the wealthiest country in the world. But the top 10% of Australians earn 31% of all income in Australia. And 12% of Australians are living below the poverty line. Disturbingly, the recent annual report of the Longitudinal Study of Households, HILDA, showed that child poverty has increased by 15% since 2001. Most Australians share a vision of an inclusive country where people, whether they are rich or poor, have access to a good quality of life. A country where poverty is on the decline rather than increasing. A country where access to health care and services is improving rather than becoming more difficult. We are going to have to work hard to achieve this within the current economic restraints, whether through reallocating funding or tax reform. This is all about deciding priorities for our nation. Now, we all care about those issues or we wouldn't be here today. How we address them is determined by our individual priorities and views, some of which are deeply held. My hope is that our approach and solution are not politically motivated and the vulnerable lose out in the process. I also hope we recognise it's the freedom to express these views that make Australia a great country, among the few in the world, where there is a genuine freedom of expression, and we should never forget that. The freedom that Australia offers is precious and must be preserved. We have the freedom to make our own choices, to exercise our right to speak out, to hold a point of view about anything and everything, to disagree, to be an individual, to travel wherever we want to in our own land, to aim for the top, to dream dreams and make them come true, to even make mistakes and learn from them, and still have the opportunity to have another go. Freedom is the incredible gift Australia gives all of us, and it's something that we can't put a price on. Sure, life can be difficult at times and things do go wrong. I know that, and I know all of you know that too. We can lose our job, experience loss of income, a closing of business, illness, suffer the effects of drought and bushfires, but we never lose our freedom. Even when our lives are at their lowest ebb, we still have freedom of speech and movement. And I am confident that the spirit we have, combined with freedom, will enable us to successfully meet the challenges of the future. Of course, Australia has many other benefits that are important to the way we live. We do have a vast and beautiful country. Geographically, Australia is extraordinary, with its dry, arid areas, its lush plains, magnificent coast, and snow fields. We have immigrants from more than 170 countries now calling Australia home and bringing to our island continent their cultures, knowledge and skills, all of which have been to Australia's gain. Our Aborigines are one of the world's oldest peoples, and with all the other people who make up our population, we are a fascinating, complex society, a unique mixture of old and new. Other nations look at the way we get on with each other and marvel how we've done it. But we have. We are an excellent model for the future, for other nations to follow. Yes, we have pockets of resistance. We are all aware that some racism exists. We are not perfect. But we need to keep working at righting the wrongs and not trivialise issues or seek to silent voices that raise concerns. Activism will always have its place in a free society. But when all is said and done, Australia is one of the best integrated multicultural societies in the world. So in drawing together the threads of my time as Australian of the Year, let me share with you some of the views I've formed. We have the opportunity for Australia's spirit and courage to shine through in many areas. When I accepted the honour of becoming Australian of the Year, I said that I hoped to contribute a little to achieving a more positive approach to ageing, delivering on the Alzheimer's Australia Fight Dementia campaign, and putting the spotlight on the need for more medical research for dementia. It's a privilege to have had the platform on which to promote a more positive approach to ageing and to tackling ageist attitudes in our society. I've enjoyed advocating for the new thinking that challenges us all to look after both our physical and brain health throughout our lives, and I'm encouraged by the enthusiastic reaction of Australians, both young and old. I've also enjoyed, and again, been encouraged by the reaction to my spruiking of Alzheimer's Australia's dementia risk reduction program, Your Brain Matters. It has been said that it takes some 17 years for the evidence from medical research to get translated into practice. I set myself the objective of making sure this wouldn't happen to the exciting positive research carried out in the United Kingdom and Denmark last year on the significant change in the prevalence rate of dementia between successive generations. This research forces us once and for all to put aside the assumption that dementia is an inevitable part of ageing. We now know that the prevalence rates of dementia are not set in stone, and the findings suggest prevention is possible. Improved cardiovascular health, better diet, and higher educational achievement might also play a critical role. What could be more exciting than the thought that our grandchildren may be less at risk of dementia than our own generation? Australia has the opportunity to continue leading the world in tackling dementia, not only through better quality dementia care, but also in promoting timely diagnosis of dementia, safer hospitals, and dementia risk reduction. And this must translate as a change towards those people living with dementia. There is no place for discrimination against people with dementia, indeed against age, in the Australian psyche. My activism is demonstrated through my fight for the rights of older Australians, particularly those with dementia, whose well-being is progressively dependent on others. There has been a fundamental shift in how we are thinking about care and support. For instance, for the first time, consumers are at the centre of aged care and disabilities. It is an outcome of which Alzheimer's Australia and other consumer organisations can be rightly proud. And I believe this sets the tone for this century. People with dementia have been empowered to speak out for themselves about what it's like to live with dementia and what they need to become to be full members of the society in which they live. They've adopted the slogan, "Nothing about us without us." And I and my colleagues at Alzheimer's Australia believe it is our duty and our organisation's duty to ensure that this remains the case. In addition to ageing, there are a number of other areas of social reform that I consider as critical to the Australian spirit. The first is education. Education and the knowledge that transpires are among our country's greatest assets. Scientific discovery and the harnessing and application of use of knowledge that will enable us to confront future challenges such as climate change, population ageing, and chronic disease. Tragically, many people have no idea that Australia boasts 13 Nobel laureates, scientists like Howard Florey and Peter Doherty, and more recently, Barry Marshall, Elizabeth Blackburn and Brian Smith. We also have some remarkable scientific success stories. Wi-Fi was developed by the CSIRO. The cochlear implant was developed in Melbourne. The cervical cancer vaccine was invented in Queensland. Plastic surgeon Fiona Wood, who was Australian of the Year 2005, developed a revolutionary treatment that has transformed the lives of burns victims. The value of these innovations is not limited to Australia either. They benefit millions of people throughout the world. But how many Australians know or can boast about them as accomplishments attributable to fellow countrymen and women? I'd like to see the setting up of a national register of scientific achievements so that we could consistently celebrate the phenomenal brain power that exists in our country. Education also provides opportunities for people from disadvantaged backgrounds who have the desire and drive to move up the social ladder through access to better careers. However, evidence suggests there may be a cause for concern. The differences in academic performance between our highest and lowest performing students are striking and more dependent on the influence of class, family and social background than in many other countries. And I'm thinking of countries such as Canada, Ireland, Austria, Korea, Finland and other Scandinavian countries. There is a significant achievement gap in Australia between rich and poor students, with children in the poorest schools effectively 2.5 years behind in academic achievement. Instead of being the great social equaliser, education risks becoming the great magnifier of existing disparities. More work is being done on the education reforms under the new government, but achieving greater equality within education and creating a system where education provides opportunities for disadvantaged students must be a fundamental focus if we are to aspire to the Australian dream of a fair go. One area of inequality close to my own heart is opportunities for women. I am struck by how much we have achieved in the last 50 years and how far we still have to go. I joined my first major corporate board, Australian Consolidated Press, in 1974. I became the first woman director of News Limited Australia in 1981 and the first woman director of Prudential Assurance in 1990. By now, I would have expected women to have equal representation on boards throughout Australia, yet we make up only around 15% of directors on our top ASX 200 companies and 62% of top ASX 200 companies have no female board members. This just isn't good enough. And it's not an issue only for private companies. Within the Australian Public Service, 50% of staff are women, yet only 39% of the senior executive service is women. Given how little progress women have made, I now favour the quota system. This is not the first time I've expressed this particular opinion, but it would be remiss of me not to seize this moment and this influential platform to press my argument further. Australia is all about opportunities, isn't it? I believe the federal government should pass a law similar to the one Norway passed in 2003, requiring all publicly listed companies to have at least 40% female board representation within 2 years. In Norway in 2003, it was then 9%. When voluntary compliance failed, the law became compulsory in January 2006. Firms that did not comply by January 2008 would be forced to dissolve. By April 2008, action having been taken against 77 tardy companies, all Norwegian firms had complied. And today, Norway's women's directors total 40%. It's not, of course, just at senior management levels that women struggle to get access to equal opportunities. Women who are trying to balance families, being a carer, and their careers also face difficulties. Female workforce participation rates are approximately 65%, while male participation rate is at 79%. I'm not the only one who thinks it makes economic sense to tackle these issues. Increased female workplace participation is the key to improving Australia's productivity. A study done by Ernst & Young in conjunction with Chief Executive Women found by employing more productive female workers in flexible roles, Australia and New Zealand could collectively save at least $1.4 billion in wasted wages. There are too many women in Australia today who want to be in the workforce, but due to lack of flexibility or unavailability or of affordable childcare, have to postpone their careers until their children are in school. And today, a growing number of women are putting their careers on hold in order to care for their elderly parents. This has long-term implications for their career prospects, their financial welfare, and their ability to save for retirement. Many issues, like women's lack of advancement, need to be discussed in the public forum, but often aren't because of political correctness. Political correctness is stifling debate in Australia. Captains of industry, people in leadership roles, politicians, not any of them here tonight, of course, other politicians, are hesitant to say what they think about issues because of a possible media frenzy. Social media has contributed to this hesitation. No one wants to be trending on Twitter. But we, the public, need to be able to say what is on our minds about the issues that concern us. We cannot afford to be wimps. Public debate used to be a way of life in Australia, but the debate is becoming increasingly muffled and controlled by PR spin, and this is not in Australia's best interests. Australians used to pride themselves on speaking their mind and at the same time being fair-minded, and we should never let the fear of political correctness or ambition stop us from exercising that right. We should never be afraid to tell it as it is, the way we see things that affect our nation's future. Earlier in this speech, I suggested that the Australian spirit is about lending a hand, helping those who need assistance the most, and ensuring that we all get a fair go. In no two areas of policy has this been more challenging in our history than in Indigenous affairs and immigration. We have made progress since Federation, but as we all know, there is more to do. In Indigenous affairs, we can celebrate the 1967 referendum to change the constitution to count Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians in the national census of the population and give the Commonwealth Government power to make specific laws for Indigenous people. We can also celebrate the national programs that have been put into place as a consequence over the last 40 years to support Indigenous people achieve their rights and aspirations. The implementation of land rights, and most recently, the apology. The reality, of course, is that the dispossession and discrimination that Indigenous people have experienced, and in far too many cases still experience, will not be reversed in one or two generations. And the evidence is in poor health, education and employment outcomes, and in unacceptable rates of incarceration for Indigenous people, and in widespread lack of knowledge of Aboriginal culture and history, which leads to a pervasive lack of respect. In immigration, the most recent census found that almost a quarter of Australians were born overseas, and 43% of us have at least one parent who was born overseas. In 1939, 98% of the Australian population was either born or descended from families in the British Isles. By 1979, nearly 12% of the population had no such connection, and today less than half of us report British or Irish ancestry. Many Australians share a common story of coming to our country looking for hope and opportunity. Many people from other countries have prospered through the opportunities Australia has given them and have successfully embraced the Australian way of life. Indeed, the very first Buttrose, William Buttrose, came to Australia with his wife and six children from Scotland in 1852 in search of a new life, and I am so glad he did. But we have the capacity to share our country with many more refugees than we currently welcome, and I believe we have a moral imperative to do so. Over the course of the last century, Australians have demonstrated the ability to embrace economic and social change, and the test of our Australian spirit will continue to be the readiness with which we welcome people forced to flee their own countries. I believe all Australians should reflect with pride on the building of our nation. In his short history of Australia, Manning Clark concluded, "Australians have liberated themselves from being second-rate Europeans. Australians have begun to contribute to the never-ending conversation of humanity on the meaning of life and the means of wisdom and understanding." I think that quote captures well where we stand today as Australians. But I would add the thought that nation building, indeed life, is about relationships. And if we, as individuals and a nation, are not inclusive, then we will fail to build on all the great achievements since Federation. For a long time, we've defined ourselves as an egalitarian society where everyone has a fair go in life, regardless of whether they were born rich or poor. Our aim should be to create a society in which we would want to live if we didn't know in advance whether we would be rich or poor, healthy or ill, whether we might have a disability or not, a society that marries compassion with a can-do attitude. I think that perhaps for this reason there is a groundswell of grassroots support for major social reform such as the National Disability Insurance Scheme, aged care and education, all of which strive to bring Australia closer to this ideal. We should take to international meetings the values of respect for diversity and the culture of others that we have forged in the heat of often intense debate and discord. We should be proud of our Australian pragmatism and getting things done, and we should never be afraid to question and challenge the status quo. I finished my 12 months as Australian of the Year feeling optimistic about the future and confident that in spite of the challenging times which confront us, we possess the impetus, an inherited seed of hope, which I maintain we inherit not just in our genes but from the soul of this great land of ours, to stay true to the egalitarian spirit of our nation. And at the same time, I give thanks for all that Australia has given us and which, with strong visionary leadership, will continue to give in increasing abundance to all who are blessed to call Australia home. I thank you.
Ita Buttrose, recorded at Sydney's Conservatorium of Music a few days ago. And you can find the audio and more on her Australia Day address at the RN website, abc.net.au/RN. Joe Gelonesi with you for a special Australia Day program here on RN. Now a feature on what's widely viewed as Australia's unofficial national anthem. We're about to take a waltz through a sonic tableau comprising some of the 700 versions of Waltzing Matilda, asking the simple question, why are Australians so attached to Waltzing Matilda? What is it about the song which has seen us over the past century or so invested with meanings and ideas which might actually be at odds with the song's origins? This feature was first aired on our history program, Hindsight, produced by Ian Walker.
But anyhow, here's the story of Waltzing Matilda.
Once a jolly swagman camped by the Billy Bong under the shade of a Coolabah tree.
It is a public song. It is our song, and in ways that no other song is.
Although it seems to, at times you think, well, it's rather a sad poem, but I can't think of any other tune that could take its place.
When Australians want to summon up their reserves of energy and achievement, Waltzing Matilda comes to their aid.
It's a great tune. You can sing it subtly, you can sing it boldly, you can sing it majestically, you can sing it any way you wish, and you've got something. You can tell it as a story, you know, the ghost may be heard, or you can just sing it, you know, in a rousing chorus.
I reckon Waltzing Matilda, regardless of the history behind it, I think it's taken on a life of its own. And probably most of the people that hear it don't even know the history behind it. But I don't think that matters.
We need things that will draw us into the future. And this is an ongoing argument. Within it is encoded this desire to find out who we are.
It's very unusual for people to argue so much about the origins and meaning of a song. Every single thing that you could argue about in connection with this song has been at some point. A while back, the bigger argument was whether, in fact, Banjo Paterson fraudulently claimed to be the author of it, when, in fact, it was an old folk song from somewhere else altogether. And elaborate theories were constructed to account for different ways in which the song might have reached Australia from Germany, reached Queensland from Victoria, reached Banjo Paterson's page from a folk tradition. Richard McGoffin's work primarily, and the work of some others as well, really settled that issue to the satisfaction of most people.
Well, Paterson was accused after he died of not writing Waltzing Matilda because he would never say anything about it. And my job was to prove that he did write it. But the catalyst for me to decide to write a book about it came from Oscar Mendelssohn with his Waltz with Matilda, in which he says that he was of the firm belief that Paterson did not write the words and the facts must now be faced. And a young bushman way up there set out to prove that he did.
My father's work in Waltzing Matilda really started because at that time he was still living in the district, not far from, well, 40 miles really from where most of these pivotal events took place. And he'd been passed many aspects of the story firsthand from his father, who knew Bob McPherson, who was the squatter in the story, who knew Banjo. And there'd been a lot written about the song and the fact that Banjo possibly didn't even write the song. And, of course, that fired his interest because of the fact that he lived in the district and had what he thought was the real story.
And the benefit I had was folklore, which wasn't acceptable, of course, by academics in the South. But at that time, in 1964, 66, there were 18 or 20 elderly people in their 80s and 90s who were young when it began, and I was able to talk to them. And that was tremendously valuable because a few years later would have been too late.
People forget very often that the McGoffin family was connected to the McPherson family through the land holdings in Queensland. And Richard had grown up on the property. It's almost like you can hear the land, you know, you can feel it, you can smell it in the way he describes it. But you understand that his interpretation of the evidence was based on an understanding of the fundaments of the land. I'll give you a little example. Just how long it takes to get from Winton to Dagworth Station on a horse. You know, he knows that. He knew it firsthand.
It's been said that the world's best national anthems, like the Marseillaise and the Star-Spangled Banner, have come from a turning point in history and often from a white heat of battle. So it is with Waltzing Matilda. It comes from the Shearer strikes, which changed history in Australia. It was the beginnings of modern democracy.
Well, the jolly jumbuck, you put in your trucker bag, you come a Waltzing Matilda with me.
I think it is instinctively Australian. And the version that I sing, I would have heard from my father, who was musical, and he used to play his saxophone at the dances in Kynuna when Bob McPherson, who was a good pianist, played his sister's song as a gypsy tap.
In the waterhole, drowning himself by the tulipop tree, and his voice can be heard as it sings in the billabongs, who'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda, with me? Waltzing Matilda and leading a water bag. Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me?
In 1894, shortly before Banjo turned up in that part of Queensland, on Dagworth Station there was a shootout between Unionists and the squatter and his men and the policemen. The point of the shootout was to take an opportunity to burn down Dagworth Woolshed, where they were planning to start shearing with scab labour the following day. Then the seven Union men who took off in the night and made camp near the town of Kynuna. Next morning, one of them was behaving strangely, and that one was a man who always behaved strangely, named Frenchy Hoffmeister. He ostentatiously burnt a letter and said, well, that's that sorted out, and then snuck off all on his own to a part of the side of the billabong they were camped at where no one else could see him. They report that the other campers report that they heard a gunshot at that point and found that he'd shot himself dead on the banks of the billabong. There are theories around that it may not have been as simple as that, that a suicide might have been a way of keeping people out of trouble who actually had some part in it. Later on in the morning, Bob McPherson, the manager of Dagworth, and according to the MacGoffin analysis, the squatter in the song, turned up at Kynuna police station, rode back down the Diamantina River with the three policemen who were now gathered together to the billabong where the Unionists were camped. And for the first time in the history of that part of Western Queensland, three policemen rode up to a billabong at once, together with a squatter who was mounted on his thoroughbred. And there they found a swagman said to have killed himself. This all happening in late 1894, shortly before Banjo came to the very same station, makes it seem fairly certain that those events had a part in the way he constructed the narrative of the song.
Up rode the squatter, mounted on his thoroughbred. Down came the troopers, one, two, three.
Well, Banjo Paterson was the classic example of a balladist. We're not poets. It's a different craft. It's very ancient. We are the people who the current events reporting before people could read and write. And he is a master of the craft, was taught by his grandmother, and he uses a lot of assonance, repetition of the same vowel sound, and alliteration, repetition of consonants. And then there are some letters which are quicker than others. Slow ones like L and M, and fast ones like S and T, and those come into use in things like The Man from Snowy River, where the pace gathers as he's coming down the hill.
He sent the Flintstones flying, but the pony kept his feet. He cleared the fallen timber in his stride, and The Man from Snowy River never shifted in his seat. It was grand to see that mountain horseman ride, through the stringy barks and saplings, on the rough and broken ground, down the hillside at a racing pace he went, and he never drew the bridle till he landed safe and sound at the bottom of that terrible descent.
Very clever, and he has been a master of the craft.
The second thing that I came to understand about Richard was that he is a balladist himself. In a way, he was the last of that generation, or those generations, that grew up writing bush ballads and reciting bush ballads. He studied the ballad. He formally studied the ballad. He did a correspondence course in Britain to do it, and when he was living, you know, far out bush. And it's given him a different perspective, I think, on Patterson and Patterson's poetry and that whole tradition of poetry. And again, this is something that we don't, perhaps we've lost in our understanding of that poetry.
Waltzing Matilda is an allegory like all of our nursery rhymes. They record history, and they were done in that way for particularly good reasons, usually for safety. The first level of meaning is that silly story. And then it is a record of historical events which occurred. There was a swagman, his name was Frenchy Hoffmeister. The squatter was Bob McPherson, and the three policemen were Daly, Dyer and Cafferty. So we named them, and it is a record of those events, just like the old nursery rhymes were. And, of course, the waterhole, the billabong, it's all historical. And then the third level of meaning is the real allegory, where we identify the characters in a different way. And the star of the story is the jumbuck. And it is through the jumbuck we can prove the allegory, because I don't know anybody else has ever used the word, certainly in writing. And Patterson used it in the second verse that he ever published, The Bushfire. And it was about Irish home rule, an allegory.
In the 1880s, Banjo wrote a poem called The Bushfire, an allegory. And it's, I suppose you could call it a political satire. It's a commentary on the way the British government was handling agitation in Ireland for a more autonomous system of rule there. And he likened the British Empire to an Australian sheep station.
There's Welshman's Gully, Scotchman's Hill and Paddy Mellon Flat. And all these places are renowned for making jumbucks fat. The run is England's empire great. The fire is the distress that burns the stock they represent. Prosperity, you'll guess. And the Blue Gum Bow is the Home Rule Bill that's making such a mess.
There were outer paddocks, one of which was Paddy Mellon Flat, which stood for Ireland. The squatter was Billy Gladstone, obviously Prime Minister Gladstone. And there were a lot of problems with bushfires repeatedly starting in some of these outer paddocks, like Paddy Mellon Flat. Billy was pretty sure that they were being deliberately lit.
All men can see the fire, of course, spreads on at such a bat. But who were setting it alight? I cannot tell you that.
At the end of the poem, Banjo actually explains the symbolism in the allegory and puts it very bluntly in front of you. Jumbucks stood for the wealth of the land, and it's naturally easy to surmise that when Waltzing Matilda talks about a jumbuck, it's the contested wealth of that part of the country, which one side is trying to deny to another if you take it to a logical political conclusion.
So, therefore, like a mathematical equation, the jumbuck in Waltzing Matilda is bankers' and squatters' property in Australia. The swagman is the citizen. The policemen represent excessive authority against the rights of the individual. They're overkill as the government came out with massive forces against the individuals. And then it's very strong in the last verse written by Patterson, there's no ghost. The word, and I sing it. And his voice can be heard as it sings in the billabongs, who'll come a waltzing Matilda with me?
But the swagman, he upped and he jumped into the waterhole, drowning himself by the coolibah tree. And his ghost may be heard as you walk along the billabong. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me.
That voice was the call of the Australian people for a fair society. And that's what was drowned in the 1890s.
The situation, the billabong and the coolibah tree, are naturally easy to understand as Australia in general. And there's a class struggle in there that you can easily find if you're looking for it. The Billy, according to Richard McGoffin, and he may well be right, is the same Billy that Henry Lawson referred to in a poem several years earlier, a very inflammatory poem that Lawson wrote on behalf of the strikers, in which the Billy and keeping the Billy boiling was a metaphor for the crusade of, or the campaign of, the labour movement. Lawson said something in that poem like, it's going to be time to light another fire and boil another Billy. So it's plausibly suggested, and Richard McGoffin is the one who deserves the credit for this analysis, that it's exactly that other Billy that Banjo's swagman had got going to make a cup of tea that afternoon.
Well, the reason he wrote Waltz and Matilda was quite simple. It's a reply to Henry Lawson's Freedom on the Wallaby from 1891. These people were Confederates. They were very competitive, but Patterson was aware of the trouble that Lawson got into with Freedom on the Wallaby, but he did reply, and he did it in a succinct way through the allegory. So that's the reason he wrote it. And of course, it also is a freedom song. It was important, and that's why it spread. It went like wildfire. And it reversed the tradition where normally a folk song is finally written down. But this one was written and then became a folk song. And a lot of people didn't know who'd written it.
It speaks to the Australian desire to be identified with the simple ideas of living in the outback, working hard, achieving what you can. The identification with pioneers and simple values, hard circumstances where endurance and virtue somehow won the day. I think it would have said that we're different from other people, and the difference is in what is often referred to as a laid-back style, but really meant a certain kind of reticence.
I think that the immense popularity and the understanding of the song as being something distinctly Australian everywhere in the world, it's understood that way, but that's a comparatively recent thing. I think that it wasn't until Peter Dawson did his wonderful rendition of the song in 1936 that it really took off all around the world, and we need to remember that Peter Dawson was the greatest recording star in Australian history, and he really popularised it in this wonderfully dramatic rendition.
Once a jolly swagman camped by the billabong under the shade of a coolibah tree. And he sang as he watched and waited till his billy boiled. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. And he sang as he watched and waited till his billy boiled. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Up rode the squatter, mounted on his thoroughbred. Up rode the troopers, 1, 2, 3. Where's that jolly jumbuck you've got in your tucker bag? You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. thou with me. And his ghost may be heard as you pass by that billabong. You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. Oh, you'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me.
And this week's mail brings a special request for Mrs. Willis of East Hills for Waltzing Matilda, the song that has gone into action with the diggers of this war from Timor to Tobruk.
It really took hold during World War II. It became a marching song. It became a song of hope. It became a song of Australia at a time when we needed something that we could grab hold of and think, well, you know, this is who we are and what we are, and we are going to get through this. And ever since then, I think that when Australians want to summon up their reserves of energy and achievement, that Waltzing Matilda comes to their aid.
It's been so frequently used as a piece of nostalgia for Australians abroad or Australians about to leave the country in time of war, that it's achieved a status that allows people to hear it and weep. I always find that astonishing, but it can do it to me too. It just depends on the circumstances. If you're feeling isolated in some way or you're under stress in another place, as soldiers have been, then this tune, which reminds you of home, will have the effect of bringing that nostalgia to the fore.
The term dream or dreamy has been used about that song by a number of people. One of the things that really led me to see it in that light was when I heard the earliest version of it reconstructed and sung in the 1895 melody. It moves slower, it has more of a far away feel and something of an escapist quality, as well as an implausible tone to it, which of course hasn't gone with the new melody. That's one aspect of the dream quality that it has. Another is just the possibility of putting different interpretations on it and being carried away and transported by it a little bit, depending which way your own thinking tends.
You've been listening to Who'll Come A-Waltzing from the Hindsight Program Collection. It was produced by documentary maker Ian Walker, and the sound engineer was Timothy Nicastri, and that was an edited version of the original program, which can be found on the Hindsight website. Thanks to contributors Robin Holmes from the National Library of Australia, bush poet Bill Kearns, historian Peter Forrest, Melbourne musicologist Therese Radich, writer Matthew Richardson, and from the last recorded interview before his death in 2006, the folk historian Richard McGoffin and his son Bill McGoffin. Our thanks to the National Library and to the National Film and Sound Archive, who hold the 700 known recordings of Waltzing Matilda. Apparently they've stopped counting. Sunday Extra with Jonathan Green is back next Sunday from 7, and Background Briefing returns from 8. I'm Joe Gelonesi, wishing you a very happy Australia Day, however you're spending it.